Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, one Arizona constable says the spike in evictions has taken a toll on everyone involved.
And why do sports fans react the way they do when their hometown team moves away?
But first, President Trump has paused, at least temporarily, 25% tariffs he'd announced against Mexico and Canada. Those two countries also happen to be Arizona's biggest trading partners, which means the proposed tariffs are causing concern among business leaders in the state. Todd Sanders is one of them. He's the president and CEO of the Greater Phoenix Chamber of Commerce and president of the Arizona-Mexico Commission. He is with me now to talk more about this. Good morning, Todd.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. So from your perspective, how concerned are you about the possibility of these really any additional tariffs against Mexico and Canada going into effect?
Well, I think if you watch the markets as they opened up yesterday and dropping 650 points, I think probably much of the country, much of the business community was and remains concerned about the prospect of a 25% tariff for Mexico and Canada going into effect.
Does that have any additional importance here? I mean, especially with Mexico being our largest trading partner, and it doesn't seem particularly close.
No, it's true. We've built a very solid economic relationship with Mexico over decades. And the impacts to Arizona could be substantial. I think the combined trade numbers are about $35 billion for both countries, and certainly for Arizona, we have some significant exports to Mexico. If there were to impose the same type of tariff, which would impact us, and then of course goods coming over to Arizona, which in many ways we would probably see an impact immediately. For instance, in the grocery stores, in terms of agricultural products, there would be a significant and swift impact.
What are you hearing from some of your counterparts south of the border? You serve, as I mentioned, as president of the Arizona-Mexico Commission, whose one of their main goals is to facilitate good economic ties between Arizona and Mexico.
Well, leading up to the imposition of the tariffs, I think there was a lot of questions about what that might look like, whether or not it might happen. Obviously, concerns for their economy as well. And then I think today, some of the discussions have revolved around whether or not this is about, for instance, fentanyl, or is it about something else, and whether or not the pause is going to end and it's going to be about something else, or about the free trade agreement. So I think just a lot of questions about what the next step might be.
Well, so let's talk about the fact that, yes, there's been a pause, a 30-day pause for both Canada and Mexico. But as you referenced, that still leaves some amount of uncertainty. So, like, what does sort of this yo-yoing back and forth, there's going to be tariffs, there's not tariffs, maybe there will be tariffs, like, what does that do for the business relationship and sort of the economic impact here in Arizona?
Well, yeah, economies can be fragile things. We've saw that obviously with the pandemic. We've seen what the result of interest rates going up very quickly, but barely coming down, even with a lot of work by the Fed. Inflation's still with us, not to the place where we need it to be. So there is concern about uncertainty in the market, whipsawing the economy back and forth, and what implications that might have for the future. We one of the biggest barometers that we see on a daily basis is going to the gas pump. Certainly, there is that potential of increasing fuel costs for folks and food costs. So certainly from that standpoint, having an unstable economic picture causes, I think, businesses to slow down on spending, maybe not hire where they were looking to hire. And certainly if prices go up by 25% across the board on certain items, then we could be looking at an increase in inflation. So definitely difficult to see an upside, at least from my perspective.
Is there a concern that regardless of whether the tariffs actually go into effect in 30 days or not, that, for example, maybe companies in Mexico or Canada might say, okay, usually, you know, we traditionally have bought product X from a company in Arizona, but we're really just not sure what that situation and what those prices are going to look like. Might they just look for supplies elsewhere and Arizona companies could sort of permanently lose out on customers they had had?
Well, yeah, like I said earlier, businesses don't like uncertainty. And when that uncertainty exists with, for instance, a potential supplier, and you could look at another country, you could go south, you could look at China, you could look at Europe. And certainly there is the prospect of Arizona losing out. And certainly when you think about it, the United States losing market share in Mexico to countries like China, who have made significant inroads into South America. So definitely something that I hope the administration is paying attention to.
So Todd, quickly before we let you go, what you mentioned agriculture, what other industries in Arizona stand to be most affected by these tariffs?
You bet. Well, agriculture is the biggest at about $3 billion, but computer and electronic products that we export to Mexico, as well as electronic equipment, appliances, and those combined are close to $2.5 billion. So a significant amount of items that we send to Mexico, along with mineral and ore from Arizona, things like copper. So all parts of our economy, I think, would be impacted in some way if these tariffs went into effect.
All right, we'll have to leave it there. That is Todd Sanders, President and CEO of the Greater Phoenix Chamber of Commerce, President of the Arizona-Mexico Commission as well. Todd, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Evictions have skyrocketed since the pandemic, and now we've hit a record. Landlords in Maricopa County filed more evictions in 2024 than they have in decades. The number? 87,000. That's the highest since 2005. And it points to the grim reality that a perfect storm of high rent, population growth, and an affordable housing crisis are resulting in desperate situations for thousands of Arizona families. Something goes wrong and they're out of luck.
That could be everything from, you know, a job loss to a medical emergency, sometimes a divorce, you know, all of those different kind of factors, or maybe a combination of those factors.
That's Jason Matthews, Interim Director of the Human Services Department at Maricopa County. He told me there are a lot of services they can offer to help those facing eviction, from rental or utility assistance to getting help from community legal services if someone's faced with an eviction notice. But a lot of people don't know those services exist, and he told me there's still a stigma.
But I think it's also just making sure that we are creating a space where folks don't feel that same level of shame and burden for asking for help. Mm. We see that as the number one deterrent in human services.
And he said the consequences of not getting those services can be much worse.
That eviction notice can also follow that household or that renter well into the future and actually prevent that household from getting a future lease, potentially getting other types of loans. That could be, you know, something that has a long-term effect that really kind of can stay with that client for years and years and years into the future.
For former Maricopa County resident LaDonna Banfield, the challenges to maintaining housing in Arizona were too high. She's had trouble finding housing with a prior eviction on her record, and she told me she's had to stretch to afford housing here.
Rent right now is ridiculous. It is too high. And most people, they want you to pay 2.5 to 3 times the rent. They want you to make that. And if you don't make that, then you're not going to get approved anyway.
Facing eviction again, she was living in her car when I spoke with her last fall.
It's like you're in survival mode. And so you begin the lease in survival mode. And then when you get evicted, it's like that sets you back even further. You can't find a place. Now homelessness is going up.
But for our next guest, it's all about carrying out the law with compassion. Scott Blake is the constable of the Hassayampa precinct and president of the Arizona Constables Association. And he told me the spike in evictions here takes a toll on everyone involved.
What happens is you are seeing individuals, families, sometimes multi-generational families at the worst time of their life. Mm-hmm. And that can sometimes take a human toll on those constables that are seeing that day in and day out.
How often does an eviction case end up in an actual eviction with you knocking on someone's door? Like, is that what usually happens?
No. When someone files for an eviction, so when a property manager files for an eviction, I would say that generally speaking, only about 20% of those actually go to a constable knocking on the door. And when that happens, if the tenant is there, most of them understand why we're standing there when they see us and the door opens.
They do. Okay, so it's not usually a surprise. What do you say to folks?
I always introduce myself and I will ask them, do you know why I'm here? Because if they say yes, well, the conversation changes, because sometimes you can have somebody who answers the door, lives in that house, and has no idea that the husband or the wife is not paying the rent. And you don't want to catch them off guard. If they understand why I'm there, then I let them know they have about 10 minutes to grab some things that they're going to need for the next couple of days and explain what happens from the time they walk out the door to them getting their things back.
That's a really short period of time. I mean, what do people do? What do people say?
Sometimes they'll tell me that 10 minutes isn't enough, and I'm going to look at the situation and make a judgment call on that. If it's a single mom and there are five children in the house and two dogs and one of them sick, well, maybe 10 minutes isn't enough time.
Right.
And we're going to offer them more time. On occasion, I have had to evict seniors where they have trouble getting around, or they are a veteran and possibly disabled. They're always going to be given more time. I personally believe in justice and mercy. And as long as they're working with me, I don't mind giving them more time.
What about resources? Like when you knock on someone's door and you're at the point of eviction, are there any resources left that you can offer them at that point?
There are. There are several websites I can direct them to. I actually have printed sheets. And it really depends on their background. Are they a veteran? Well, you can kind of point them in this direction. If they have a family, you can kind of point them in this direction. But most times they have a place to go because they've been thinking about this since the minute that they didn't pay their rent. You, as a human, you know that you're going to need food and shelter. And with that, many already know where they're going to go.
Why do folks tell you they haven't been paying their rent or they can't pay their rent? Like, why do you think it's gotten so much worse now than it had been in years past?
I don't know, other than is it possible that COVID has played a role in this where rent has been paid for many people for months on end, assistance from nonprofits and churches? I think that the economy is playing another role where the cost of living has increased, but the ability to earn money, I'd say a per hour rate, has decreased.
Okay, so I want to talk about the other side of this, the constable side of it, your side of it, right? Like you mentioned this at the beginning, and I think this is really interesting, that this must be really mentally and emotionally challenging. Like you mentioned, having to evict families, seniors, veterans. How do you train for that? How do you handle it?
Personally, I am a faith-based person. We offer classes on how to deal with this. It's no secret that in law enforcement, suicides trend much higher than many other professions. There are de-escalation techniques when dealing with somebody who is agitated. Constables have a lot of tools on their tool belt. Many of them will carry a taser, a gun, an expandable baton. But the number one tool on your tool belt better be communication, because talking to people, sometimes talking them off of a ledge, is going to be important and probably going to be used.
Tell us about some of those moments. Have you been in situations that get really tense where you have to talk people down? Do people ever fight you, refuse to leave?
Yes, people will fight you and then refuse to leave. And my philosophy is you can always back out and come back to the situation with more people. Mm-hmm. I've had training in critical incidents on how to be able to communicate people who are in a crisis situation and be able to move their mind and their thought pattern off of possibly saying that they want to kill themselves now. I've had that happen. They want to kill others in their home, or when they leave, they're going to do harm to themselves. That training for me has been invaluable.
What do you want people to know about what you do and why you do it?
You have to remember that you have an individual who can't pay their rent, and although they do need a place to live, we also have an owner who needs to receive money to either pay for that house. I recently was at an eviction where the owner of the home was a retired couple, and they had bought that house because they knew their retirement dollars would not be able to carry them through. And the very first people they rented to, it didn't work out for them.
So there's always kind of two sides to the story.
There is.
All right, we'll leave it there. Constable Scott Blake, the constable of the Hassayampa precinct and president of the Arizona Constables Association. Scott, thank you so much for coming on and talking to me about this. I really appreciate the perspective.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, why one expert says fans shouldn't feel bad about grieving the loss of their sports team.
But first, it's time for the next edition of our series, Made in Arizona.
I could take risk with embroidery in a way that I couldn't take risk in other areas of art.
A lot of my paintings, gravity doesn't matter a whole lot.
Dance wasn't something that is necessarily seen in galleries, you know? And I just remember being like, this is the key. This is how dance gets out there.
I try to tug at people's heartstrings and try to do something disturbing.
I escaped real life and I went back in time.
Today, meet Anthony Serra. He's the Tony in Tony's Magic Bix, a fertilizer with a cult following that gardeners across Arizona swear by. You can find his secret plant elixir at local nurseries all over the state, and I spoke with him recently about how he came up with it. Turns out, gardening is in his blood.
It started out as a high school job. My father had a nursery, and I just started working in there to help him out and everything down in Tucson, and just kind of grew from there and wasn't sure what to do and wandered around aimlessly, always working in the nursery. And if I wasn't fishing, I was out playing in the garden. And so it grew on me over the years. And when it came time to go to the university, that's what I pursued, got a degree in horticulture and graduated with honors.
So you studied this, you have a degree in horticulture, like you said. So, I mean, explain that to folks, because this is like, I think, a hobby for a lot of people. But when you study this, it's pretty scientific, right?
Oh, yes. Very scientific. You're getting down into the nitty gritty. What people don't realize is a lot of what we even learned, like even genetics and everything, we learned from studying plants.
Do you see sort of a connection between plants, between these kinds of living things and us?
Oh, yes. Yeah. I mean, just like us, plants are as unique and different as you and I are. A little example. I got a few broccoli plants growing at our house in the garden, just sprouted seed. Mm-hmm. And there's about 8 or 9 plants in there. And one of them right in the middle, we dropped to 25 degrees at my house last week. And out of all of them, only one plant froze.
Huh.
And it was the one right in the middle. So it was even somewhat sheltered by the other plants. And so it's what I try and tell everybody. You may buy 5 tomato plants and plant them all the same and think you're watering them the same, but they're as unique and different as you and I are. There's no two that are the same.
That's really interesting. So you turned this into a business at some point. Was it the mix itself that sprouted that business for you?
What started the whole thing is back when I started out in the nursery, we were still using chlordane and all the other really, really nasty chemicals were out. So I never really cared about organics one way or another. And then about 10 years ago, roughly, a lot of the organics started coming available in Arizona. I was managing a nursery here in Tucson. And I said, okay, we're going to be selling them. I got to sound intelligent talking to customers about them. So I took home all kinds of different ingredients, played around with them, had a bunch of stuff left over in a bucket, just dumped it, put it on the side, and a little while later needed the bucket, dumped everything out underneath my lemon tree, and my lemon tree just took off like amazing. It just said, hey, I love whatever you just dumped on me. And I said, okay, here's what I might have had in there. And I started playing around with it and looking at it and looking at different ingredients. I said, well, what could I do that might be different? And if you're going to do this, let's try and improve the health of the soil at the same time. And I ended up converting myself from synthetics to organics. And what organics do is they promote the beneficial bacteria and fungi in the soil. So think of probiotics for your guts.
Right.
You get a good, healthy soil biome is what they call it. And this makes for better plants. I had a good friend, God rest his soul, Rick Kober, who came up with a saying, happy roots make for happy shoots. So I started looking at all the different organic ingredients out there. What were others doing? And I settled on bat guano as the base.
And you have to explain to folks here what bat guano is. I have to stop you because okay, I had to look it up.
So bat guano is just a fancy way of saying manure. And so the difference right. between guano and manure is about $5 a pound.
Okay. So bat guano is where you begin. And then you started to add in lots of other things. I mean, but the list of ingredients, and I know some of this is kind of proprietary, kind of a secret, but you've got kelp meal, molasses, neem seed meal. Like this is super specific stuff. How did you come up with what went into this mix?
I started looking at it and researching it. So, okay, number one, we know kelp is already good, the potassium, and there aren't a whole lot of sources to do potassium for organic. And kelp, you've got a lot of the minerals that also come from the ocean.
So you kind of zeroed in on this mix at some point, although it took you a long time, it sounds like. You had a big, like, 5-gallon bucket, and you're just trying different formulas and planting them?
I was playing around in a 5-gallon bucket, mixing manure by hand. For a couple of years, giving out samples to all my customers, getting feedback from them. Okay, that worked. This didn't work. Change this. Up the amount. Decrease the amount. They were telling me, hey, Tony, we finally think we got it. My plants are growing better, stronger, healthier. The fruit tastes better. I had several people tell me their tomatoes tasted better.
So was it about the ingredients that you put in there and what they do to the plant, or is it about the soil itself?
Well, so it's making the soil biome, the beneficial bacteria and fungi happy, which makes the plants happy.
Right.
And it was some of the ingredients. I never really been able to try and trace it down. And I won't claim that you won't have insect issues. But I think what it is, there's ideas floating around that it leads to higher Brix levels in the plant. Brix is the measure of the natural sugars in the plant.
Okay.
Another one is some of the volcanic ash in there has silica. I think the silicates are making the foliage stronger and less palatable to the insects.
So when did people start referring to it as Tony's Magic Mix? Like, where did this name come from?
So I went to everybody who was my guinea pigs. I said, great, you guys were my guinea pigs. You now get to name it. And so it was Tony's Pixie Dust. It was Tony's Fairy Dust. It was Tony's this. I said, look, I'm not trying to name it after myself. So it became Tony's Magic Mix.
So, I mean, having grown up at a nursery here, studied it, created this particular, you know, kind of mix with a cult following, right? Tell us, what do you think is unique about gardening in Arizona and in the Southwest in general? Like, this is not, it doesn't follow the normal kind of gardening or weather patterns that you would see, like on the East Coast, for example.
Well, so number one, we have two seasons here. Most people aren't used to two seasons. We got warm and cool season. So, you know, warm season is spring, and then you do what you can to keep some things alive through the summer. And then this time of the year, in the fall through spring, you've got growing all kinds of root crops, lettuce, broccoli, cabbage, onions, garlic, all that stuff. So you're gardening here year round. There's such a wide variety of what we can grow here, which is what makes us special and unique.
So for those folks who do not have a green thumb, who do not think that they can grow a garden, especially in the desert, what's your advice? Like, what do you think they should think about as they try this if they want to?
The biggest thing is proper watering. So you want to get very good soil, so get some really good quality compost, and don't be afraid to water. As an example, and my wife will hate me for this, our garden's 15 by 25 at the time, roughly. And she'd go out and spend 15, 20 minutes watering with the hose, and things are wilting again by the end of the day.
Right.
I'm growing everything full sun in Tucson, no shade. I'd come home from work. I'd go out and spend an hour watering the garden.
An hour?
6:30 in the evening. And the next day at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, full sun, 105, 108 degrees out, nothing's wilting.
Huh.
You got to really soak it.
So let me ask you lastly, Tony, about just why you love this, right? Like, this is your whole life. You've been doing this since you were a kid, it sounds like. I mean, what do you love about growing your own food? What do you love about teaching people how to do it themselves?
It's just sharing the knowledge that God bestowed on me is I think the biggest thing, and watching people see and enjoy the fruits of their own labor. And of course, enjoying my own stuff. I mean, walking out and picking a 30-pound watermelon from your garden and, yeah, and having that for dinner, there's nothing better than that.
All right. Well, we'll leave it there for now. That is Anthony Serra joining us, the owner of Earth's Original Organics and Tony's Magic Mix. Thank you so much for coming on. Thanks for telling us your story. I really appreciate it.
I greatly appreciate the opportunity, and thank you for having me.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Rachel Syme is a writer with a massive audience. She's on staff at The New Yorker, where she often profiles cultural luminaries like Lena Dunham and recently Severance star Adam Scott. But one of her favorite ways to write is much more personal. Syme is a devotee of the ancient art of correspondence, better known as letter writing. And in a new book called Syme's Letter Writer, she offers a practical guide to an increasingly impractical tradition. Syme spoke with the show's Sam Dingman.
Rachel, one of my favorite things about this book is the case that you make for letter writing. And the case that you make is kind of that there is no real case for it.
Exactly. I'm not about to evangelize for it as a kind of communication that is vital or necessary in the modern world, which I think actually freed me up when working on this book, because if this is not something that is crucial to daily life or needed anymore, it becomes something else that can be a form of sort of slow, mindful friendship building. It can be a catharsis. It can be a channel for understanding yourself and others. So there are so many things that letter writing can be.
Yeah. I mean, I agree with you in the sense of vital as defined as like necessary.
Yeah.
There's nothing vital, but there is so much vitality in the sense of like life to...
Yes. Though you are only writing to one person, your reader is maybe the most receptive reader you will ever have in your life. When you write a letter, you can almost guarantee, especially because it's such a novel way of getting your point across these days.
Absolutely. And I am so glad you brought up this phenomenon of there being an audience of one. That's a phrase that you use throughout the book. And I was so, this is going to sound ridiculous, moved by that, because... There is so much pressure in modern culture for what you make or what you write or what you put out into the world to be appealing to the masses and to be the kind of thing that generates traffic. And
oh, yeah. I mean, that's completely part of it. There is something so interesting about writing something that you know will be read. It's not for nobody, but it is also only going to be read for one person who is most likely your friendliest reader, who wants to engage with you on this deep level, on the line level, on the word level, on the overall aesthetic level, and who you are writing to get a response back. So there is an interchange and a constant, like it's just a snowball of communion. It's like getting to know someone through letter writing is probably the slowest, but also the most meaningful way you could get to know somebody. And yeah, the truth is, like, letter writing, I realized how much more substantive my connections were feeling when I didn't feel like my writing was needed to be palatable for the larger public or felt like marketing or felt like, you know, an extension of my quote unquote brand, but that it was just me on the page where I met the work and then the other person met me.
One of the things that's great about the book is that in addition to all of these practical guides, you also do all this lovely writing throughout it where you tell the stories of your own engagement with doing this practice. And you tell this amazing story about developing a correspondence relationship with this woman who now is a regular guest at your home for Thanksgiving.
Amy. But, yeah.
But my favorite scene is the one where you talk about meeting her for the first time in person after exchanging all these letters back and forth. Can you give us a little sense of what that moment was like for you?
Yeah. I mean, I met her on the street in Brooklyn outside my apartment because she was coming to stay with me for Thanksgiving. She lives in Chicago where she's a midwife. And I hugged her like I had known her for 20 years. We had just been writing letters for 2 years, I think, at that point when she finally came. I think it was a year and a half or 2 years.
There was something for me about that scene that it made me think about times in my life when I have met people that I know I share an interest with because of social media. So the example that comes to mind is tweeting about baseball games.
Sure.
And I have had experiences of then going to games and meeting up with these folks that I exchanged tweets with all the time. And we have something to talk about for 5 minutes. And then we realize we don't actually really know each other at all. And I had this sense with you and Amy that you almost didn't need to talk when you exchanged the hug because there was this realization of how deeply you knew each other because of the
Goodness. I mean, it did get really intense really fast with Amy, in so much as it was like, here's my hopes and fears and dreams. Here's what I stay up late at night worrying about. Here's my stuff about my childhood. Here's stuff about her childhood. Here's stuff about, I think that the wonderful thing about letter writing is that it kind of preserves the part of you that's always 13 years old and just wants to make a new friend and like makes a friend at camp, you know, it kind of has like a summer camp feel to it. And so much is like, you kind of come with that purest part of yourself that just really wants to find a kindred spirit.
I love this idea of it unlocking your inner 13-year-old.
Yeah.
I think of that time in my own life, which I imagine many people feel the same way, as a time when I felt constantly like I have so many feelings and I
exactly.
want to
talk about them.
But as an adult, honestly, I still feel that way, but it feels way more taboo or unwelcome, particularly in a place like social media. If you do that, the backlash can be swift and career threatening.
Not only that, I mean, also just with your friends, they can get sick of you. Like, I think that that you have to see every day. I mean, if you're just constantly like, oh, I'm having this issue. Like, there is this kind of like unwritten, unspoken code with letters where it's kind of like anything you put in here goes into the vault. This is a bubble we're both in. We can both sort of talk about, our teenagerist hopes and fears and preoccupations, and you will be met with the same kind of energy.
You have this quote that you come back to at least a couple times in the book, and I apologize, I forget who said it, but the quote is, "A letter always finds its destination."
It's a Lacanian quote, Jacques Lacan. Uh-huh. And, you know, at that point, I think he's talking about some sort of psychoanalytic concept. But the way that I understand that to be is that intention kind of always finds its mark. Maybe it takes a few tries and a few lost letters along the way.
Yeah. Even if the letter you wrote doesn't reach the person it was intended for, you did find the practice of letter writing. And
you found the practice of letter writing. You learned something about yourself. You did a creative act that maybe took up an afternoon that would have otherwise been spent binging Netflix. Like, you know, there's so many things that you can get from this practice that are not about the actual physical sending and receiving of letters, though, of course, that's a big part of it. And I think there's so few things that are so low stakes and so high reward than writing letters to me. So really, that was the whole point of this book, was just like, I'm enthusiastic about this thing.
Yeah.
Maybe you are too.
Well, the book that came out of it is Syme's Letter Writer, A Guide to Modern Correspondence. And I've been speaking with Rachel Syme, who is a staff writer at The New Yorker by day and the author of the book. Rachel, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you so much. Thank you. And send me your address. I'll write you a letter.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger.
The National Hockey League is more than halfway through its current season. That means the Utah Hockey Club, the team formerly known as the Arizona Coyotes, has played more than half a season in its new state. The Coyotes called the Valley home for 27 seasons, but the threat of relocation was there during many of them, especially recently, from questions of ownership to debate over a suitable arena where they would actually play their games. I personally never really got into the Coyotes. I rooted for them to do well, but didn't follow the team that closely. And I'm a pretty big sports fan. While baseball is my favorite, either in person or on TV, I enjoy watching just about any sport. While it may have seemed a bit odd, especially when the team first moved here from Winnipeg, Canada, to play ice hockey in the desert, the Coyotes did have a dedicated following. And for a lot of those fans, the experience since the team left for Salt Lake City has been tough. At their last game, a win over the Edmonton Oilers in Tempe last April, my colleague Nick Sanchez caught up with a few of them.
For the past week, every day I've gone through the five stages of grief. On a daily basis, you run through bargaining and denial and acceptance and anger. And so, yeah, this is very bittersweet. Honestly, it's this is the longest standing relationship I've had. You know, they've been here for more than half my life. But it's hard. It's hard.
Whoever's playing in the desert, I want to be here and I want to support them. We're already talking about flying to Salt Lake if we can with our Coyotes jerseys to support them there. We want to keep supporting them wherever they are, and we want to welcome a new team. If that's what's going to happen, if the Roadrunners are going to stay here, we want to support them no matter what. We want to show that hockey belongs here.
Typically, at the end of a game, fans start filing out of the stadium or arena. Sometimes, if the home team's not playing well, they get a head start. But as the last horn sounded to end that last Coyotes game, nobody left for at least half an hour. Also, nobody was sitting down. The fans who had packed Mullet Arena stood, clapping, a last salute to their team and their players. Or maybe an attempt to prolong the team's existence in the Valley. Or maybe they just didn't know what to do next. The players, too, stuck around. They shook hands, hugged each other, and skated around the ice waving to fans long after they'd have normally retreated to the locker room. At one point, they started throwing hockey sticks, pucks, hats, and other souvenirs into the stands. It was like they didn't want the moment to end. Or maybe they just didn't know what to do next either. I wasn't at that game, but I saw it. It had been a while since I'd watched a hockey game, but on that April evening last year, I found myself on the couch with the TV on. And as I watched the players milling around on the ice and the fans standing, clapping, cheering, holding up signs, I was taken back to a similar April evening in 1997.
Face off in the zone. That's all that remains. And the crowd is cherishing every moment. Morton in the corner. It's over, folks. It's been a great ride. The Whalers will go out winners.
I grew up just outside Hartford, Connecticut. I was away at college on the night of the last ever Hartford Whalers game, a win over the Tampa Bay Lightning. After that final horn sounded, the players stayed on the ice. The fans stayed in the stands. The team tossed pucks, sticks, and gloves into the crowd. The team captain spoke.
And on behalf of all the players that have left Hartford and the guys that are sitting on this bench, we just want to say thank you from all of us. God bless, and thank you very much.
Everyone knew it was ending, but maybe not just yet. I'd been going to games at the Hartford Civic Center for years. I knew all the players. I had the t-shirts and hats, posters on my childhood bedroom wall, read the box scores, the whole bit. And then it was gone. Over. We all knew that season would be the Whalers' last in Hartford, that they'd be moving to North Carolina to become the Hurricanes. But we knew that in our heads, in our hearts, there was still a chance, right? As it turns out, no, there was no chance. The team moved. It even won a Stanley Cup in 2006. But I wasn't cheering for them. On the contrary, I was actively rooting against the Hurricanes. Even as I hoped they'd fail in their post-Hartford existence, however, I wondered, why did I care so much?
We have undervalued the importance of fandom in the lives of fans. It's not just a casual pastime for these individuals. It matters to them in deep and profound ways.
That's Daniel Wan, a psychology professor at Murray State University who studied the psychology of sports fans for more than three decades. And he says it makes perfect sense for fans of particular teams to feel whatever they feel if their team leaves town.
The individuals, when their favorite team, if it's a team that they love and have loved for a long time, when that team leaves, it's a loss. I can't say that it can be equated with the loss of a loved one, of a family member, but the process is quite similar. There's this void, this something missing in their life that was so central to who they are and such a big part of, you know, how they structured their lives and things that they did, that, you know, if that thing is gone, we would be grossly misunderstanding the human psyche if we thought that fans could just shrug their shoulders and move on.
I, for one, was not able to just shrug my shoulders and move on. I was angry. Angry about the fact that the team had left and angry about the way it went down. I was sad. This was the only hometown pro sports team in Connecticut at the time, a real point of pride. I was a little lost sports-wise. But my reaction was not universal. I had friends who did move on and rooted for other teams. My good friend and next-door neighbor growing up actually eventually became a Hurricanes fan. Juan says that's not unexpected. When a fan's team leaves town, he says, there are a lot of potential responses. Some fans will swear off the team, while others will follow them. Some fans will root for the players that wore their team's jersey, but not root for their new team. Others will give up on the sport altogether. It happened when the Whalers left Hartford. It happened when the Coyotes left the Valley. It's happening as the A's leave Oakland and will happen when the next team leaves its home city. Juan says there's a range of reactions fans take when their favorite team is uprooted.
To sort of come back to the analogy of when you've lost a loved one, everybody grieves a loss differently, right? There's no cookie cutter way that we are going to grieve for a lost loved one. The same is true when we've lost an important part of our lives, whether it's a favorite sport team has left, or maybe a favorite amusement park is shut down, or maybe we've been relocated and now we're no longer at the place of employment that we love forever. When we have these losses in our lives, something has to give and people have to cope in a certain way, and they cope differently. Everybody is different. And I think that that's one of the critical things that I like to tell people that are experiencing this type of a loss is that it's okay to feel those ways, right? I mean, sometimes fans are like, it's just a team. Why do I care so much? Why am I so sad? You're sad because it mattered to you. And it's okay to have those feelings.
That's an interesting point you make, because I think for a lot of people, and I fell into this category, anyone who knows me knows that I was and continue to be a fan of the Hartford Whalers, a hockey team that left Central Connecticut while I was in college. And when they left, I remember feeling a deep sense of loss. But at the same time, I remember feeling, this is silly. It's a sports team. And having people who weren't fans of sport at all saying, what do you care? It's just a team. Like, nobody died. Like, you didn't lose a friend. You didn't lose a job. You didn't get kicked out of school. You lost a sports team. And it seems as though there's sort of this, I don't want to say it's shame, but this sort of internal feeling of, why do I care so much? It's a sports team. But as you're saying, it is a loss.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned that, because one of the things that we have found in the research is that when you talk to sports fans and you ask them, so how does being a fan of this team or this sport provide meaning and purpose in your life? They sort of first say, well, I don't know really that it does. And then you like go into it further and they just have this light bulb go off and they realize, oh my gosh, you know, it does. I wake up in the morning and it matters to me. And I'm excited because I can talk to my friends about last night's game, or it gives me, you know, this idea of how I want to structure my vacation. It gives us this sense of meaning and purpose. So then if fans undervalue what sport matters to, how sport matters to them, it's not that surprising when that thing is taken away that they're surprised at just what the sense of loss is, right? Yeah. But from an academic perspective, it makes very good sense. And so when people look at somebody and say, well, it's just a sports team, you know why? Just follow them now that they're in Utah. For the fan, it is so much not that simple.
I'm curious what it says to you about fans who try to root for another team. So when, again, going back to my example, when the Whalers left, I tried to become a fan of the New York Rangers. I'm a fan of a number of other New York sports teams. And I thought, okay, I'll give this a shot. Because I certainly, even though I love the players, I couldn't root for the team that they became in Carolina. I tried to root for the Rangers and it lasted like 10 minutes. I just couldn't get invested in it. So I wonder what that says to you psychologically about people, because I'm sure there are people in Arizona who've thought, okay, I'll root for the Utah Hockey Club and just can't.
Yeah, I refer to that as the rebound team. that everybody's like, okay, so I've lost this love. And so now I'm on the rebound and I've got to go search for the next best option. And that option rarely, not never, but rarely matches up. Right. It never reaches what we had before, because think about it. If you're a fan of Team A and you have been for months, years, decades, generationally even, and all of a sudden you're like, well, they're gone, so I'll go find something else. Golly, how many things about Team B are now not the same? Right. So many parts of following Team A just aren't there.
Does it seem to matter? Have you found that it matters at all the way in which a team leaves? For example, like the Baltimore Colts, the football team, left. Basically, they packed up a U-Haul van and left in the middle of the night. Nobody knew it was coming. I'm thinking about the Oakland A's, a more recent example, where they are allegedly going to Las Vegas, but they're going to play a couple of years in Northern California first, which is seeming like maybe a more messy relocation than, for example, the Coyotes, who just went to Salt Lake City. Like, does it matter the manner in which the leaving happens?
Yeah, such a great question. I always think about it, again, back in terms of romantic relationships, and people always talk about, wow, it was a good breakup. The best breakup is still an ugly breakup. So yes, you know, the Colts leading in the middle of the night. I mean, you said nobody knew. Somebody knew. The bus drivers knew, right? But yeah, they did a great job of keeping it from the fans. They kept it from the people who would really want to know. And then there's the Oakland A's who, I mean, they have known for years that things are in trouble. And so it's always like, do you want the instant death or do you want the slow death? Mm. Neither one of them sound very good when you get right down to it. Yes, they do change the fans' reaction.
Juan says just like there are a variety of fan responses when their team leaves town, there isn't a consensus about how those fans will feel down the road either. Loss is a funny thing, he says, and the passage of time heals, whether it's the end of a romantic relationship or the end of a relationship with your favorite team. And like the advice you might get when a personal relationship ends, Juan suggests trying to remember the good times, not the bad ones. And keep in mind that something else will eventually come along, whether it's a new team or a new interest. More than 20 years after the team left Hartford, I still wear my Whaler shirts and hats, like a lot. And while I've bought most of them since the team has ceased to exist, both vintage and new merch are big sellers, they still make me think of my childhood and the pride of rooting for a small market perpetual underdog. There's still a tiny piece of me that dreams of an NHL team skating in Hartford again, even though it's been close to 30 years since I actually lived there. But I know how unlikely that is, probably as unlikely as the Yankees relocating from the Bronx to the Constitution State. And I'm okay with that. When I think about it, I try to remember the good times, with my family and friends attending games at the Civic Center, cheering on our hometown team, and roaring when the delightfully cheesy song Brass Bonanza would play after a goal, rather than the sadness we felt when we knew it would all be over.
Brought a tear to my eye there, Mark. Sorry for your loss.
Part of the soundtrack of my childhood right here, Lauren.
You got the song. It's so great. I love it.
One of my all-time favorites right here.
That's it for this episode of The Show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.